Our panel today is on spiritual journey, and of course I haven't had a tremendous amount of time to think about that this week. It's been kind of a crazy week, but we had asked, originally had hoped to have one of the young people on it, but Rick was jealous of the time that they had left to spend downstairs, so he asked the kids to write something, which Dean is going to read to start out, and then the rest of us are going to speak briefly, and then we're hoping that people would want to share their thoughts.
Okay, this is from the high school class, and I think it took the form of an interview, and Rick came up with the questions, and then he summarized their responses for me here, so I will read them for you now. The question, where do you see yourselves in 5 years' time? Well, they all saw continuing their educations while at college, and they all plan to travel, and one combines both visions because she hopes to study in a foreign country. Will you be involved in a church or a religion? If so, how and why? Well, the high schoolers would like to be involved in a church, but they think it will be more difficult to do so than it is now. They may not have enough time, and several said they may not have opportunities to be involved in Unitarian Universalist societies since the denomination is so small. None mentioned participating in other churches or religions, but they also noted the absence of college-age people here at Prairie. They plan to pursue religious studies informally with college friends and try to find people who have similar thoughts. What steps do you plan to take in your religious search? Be a hermit. Live in the wilderness. Or take a journey of discovery. Visit various places. Seek the right place. Be open to change and remain unafraid. Search for a clearer understanding of family and family history. Live life according to the golden rule. Where do you see yourself in 10 or 20 years' time? All of them see themselves in a family, and most with children. They will be settled down and working, perhaps self-employed. Many think they will become teachers, such as in a high school. They are hopeful, but they understand that life is not fair, and they anticipate that 20 years will bring them a share of sorrow. How do you think your religious beliefs and religious journey will inform your life? And here's a variety, again, of answers. Live as a religious person. Do good. They expect that the best chance of getting a good life is to be good. They subscribe to the idea that you get in return that which you give. They will seek people of similar values with whom to associate. They hope to learn from all experiences, even the bad ones. They agreed with the person who stated that who you are is the only thing over which you have control. It is up to the individual to enjoy what life gives. Will you be willing to marry or partner with a person of a different faith community? Yes, if the person shared an underlying commonality of values and they accepted my religious beliefs as valuable. The person they hope to marry would be able to listen and share a belief in good communication. And that was the end of the serious part. the final question was, what would you like to add? Number one, it would be great not to have to worry about money. Number two, don't fall asleep. And number three, more penguins.
Thanks, Jim. When we were thinking about this panel, and the panel was presented to us as a spiritual journey, one of the things became very clear, and that is there was no unity in the idea of what spirituality meant. And I was disappointed that the kids didn't, I mean, that they took it, Rick's questions took it from a religious viewpoint rather than a spiritual viewpoint. As I was thinking about it, you know, first of all, of course, my you know, when you think of journey, you think, well, where did you begin? And I was thinking about my, you know, I was taken to the Universalist Church in Syracuse when I was maybe 6, 7, if that, by my best friend. Her parents, and we were unchurched, and her parents asked if I could go with them, which I did, and found a tremendously good marriage with my kind of underlying personality. And when they moved away, I insisted on continuing going, and my mother, who didn't want to sit in the parking lot, went to church and discovered that was what she wanted. So I always say I'm the first generation, my mother's the second. But as I was thinking about this, what, you know, in terms of what I got from that experience, I got my philosophy, my way of looking at life, kind of my ethics, but I don't think I got what I would call spirituality. Which, again, was, as Lisa and I were talking about this yesterday, and trying to define it, and having a hard time, but it being more, to me anyway, has nothing to do with spirit kind of out there, but more of a sinking into a place within myself that... a quiet place within myself, a peaceful place within myself. And I've always been rather a hyperkinetic person, so I don't think I ever stopped long enough. You know, I got the ethics and the philosophy, and but I didn't stop long enough to ever sink into that inner place, except very rarely to touch it like mountain climbing by my, you know, and kind of finding myself alone on a mountaintop, or that sort of thing, briefly maybe would touch that spot. And then my cousin, who's a Quaker, for his marriage, they got married on an island in Cranberry Lake, which is in the Adirondack Mountains. And that his family has this beautiful large old house with this big veranda around it. So they had everybody outside in chairs. They had the wedding couple kind of in the corner, and people spread out on two sides. And of course, even in a Quaker marriage, much of the ceremony is silent. And I discovered such a peace in that. It was just wonderful to just be there with all these people, but quiet and still, with just, you know, the birds twittering. And since then, I've gone to a couple of other Quaker services, and I always find this wonderful peace in sitting with people in silence, which is something, like I said, I was always kind of a hyperkinetic kid. I didn't ever stop. And I resent it then when somebody gets up and talks, you know, you're inspired and you're supposed to stand up and say something. Shut up. I want to hear you. I want to be in my space. So that's, I think, I consider that sort of the beginning of the spiritual aspect of my journey. Or the rest of it was all important, but it didn't hit that deep place inside. And so in terms of continuing the journey, that's why I was, you know, Dean and I were bidding like crazy on Lisa's meditation lessons, at the Prairie Auction, because that I'd like to find that, I'd like to go further in that. I would seriously consider being a Quaker if I wasn't so committed to prayer, you know. So that's kind of how I see my journey forming and progressing. And I see myself of this panel the least developed.
That probably means she's the most developed. I'm going to briefly just mention how I happened to become a Buddhist. Try not to go on too long about that. But my father was born Reuben Goldberg, the son of Jewish immigrants, very poor. He was a construction worker, disabled, in New York City. And the only thing his father asked of him was that he become a good Orthodox Jewish boy, and my father did not comply. He completely disassociated himself with Judaism. His goal was to become an American, and I thought that was quaint. He told me that some time ago, I think about 2 years ago when he was visiting. Some of you met Reuben. But when he left, he just decided to build himself. He wanted to become successful, and he worked very hard, and he climbed the ladder of relative success. And the one thing he told me, well, I didn't know we were Jewish. Our last name was Goldberg, and when I was in high school, one of the teachers said, Lisa, would you please prepare a talk on Hanukkah? You know, I had no idea. So I said,
where did you grow up?
I grew up first in California, which was such a melting pot, no one said anything. Then we moved to St. Louis, which is where this happened. So anyway, no association with that heritage. But the one thing my father gave me as his opinion of the most important thing that I should read is he handed me the book How to Win Friends and Influence Others, or People, by Dale Carnegie, and what it was. And I love my father, and this was the best he had to give. This is what came down to him through his background. And he said, if you don't read anything else, please read this. So I was going to find it in the library, but I didn't have time. But what I remember is, it's all like, remember somebody's name and repeat it. And look in their eyes. You know, it was all the external things that you should do to be successful in the world. And that was that. That was Dad's side. And Mom's father was a minister, an itinerant minister in a fundamentalist church called Disciples of Christ. So on a couple of different occasions, we went for maybe a few months at a time, and I congratulate Mom for attempting to give us some kind of religious upbringing. It kind of worked to a point, because we moved around a lot, and I had a lot of conversations with God as I was a child, God the Father. And they were mostly supplicatory. I was telling him that I would be a good little girl if he would just give me, you know, I had a list of whatever my thought. So my faith began to waver because the list was not fulfilled. So also, there were a couple of other things. I had an intellectual problem with the idea of God the Creator. I couldn't quite figure out, okay, I like the idea, God created the earth. That's pretty simple and profound. But I always wonder, who created God? You know, so it was like back to square one. And then the final straw that caused me to leave the church was I was really bothered when the minister said that if you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, you could be saved. But if you didn't believe that, you were going to go to hell. Now, that didn't make sense to me at all, because I thought of the Hindu kids and, you know, kids from other countries. So I was very shy, but this was important, so I asked Dr. Bowman about it. And he said, I said, well, what if a Hindu child was really a good kid, you know, and they were a good Hindu and they told the truth and they loved their grandmother, would they then be able to go to heaven because their village is Hindu and their family? And Dr. Bowman looked at me, bless his heart, and he said, they would somehow receive the word about Jesus Christ. And so that was it. So anyway, I was out of there. And so the spiritual thing was kind of on the back burner for a number of years until I was in India. And I was traveling around the world on an adventure. And I really was not seeking something spiritual, but I was sitting by a river in India, and I saw these two elderly men. They were dressed very scantily, loincloths or something. But the thing that struck me about these guys was they were graceful. And I don't know if I'd ever seen a truly graceful-looking person. They were making a meal by this river, and it was probably real ordinary in their lives. But I watched the way they moved, and it was... there was a mindfulness, kind of what you're talking about. They had sunk down into themselves. And they seemed to be grateful. They were giving thanks or something. And I always remembered that moment because their behavior was different than anything I'd ever seen. So I signed up for a 10-day meditation course. I didn't realize you got up at 4:30 in the morning and started meditating, and all you did all day was meditate. So after the first couple of days, I thought, I've got to get out of here. But I stuck it out, and that was like a turning point in my life because I met myself for the first time. I kind of stopped thinking. You know, I'd always been thinking about how he wasn't fair to me, and my dad liked the little kids better and gave them all the special things, and you know, all these little resentments, and what does he think of me? And, you know, everything, my mind was so busy, I never just settled down and breathed. And so that was the birth of my spiritual awareness, sort of similar, I think, to what you experienced in the Quaker setting of the wedding. So it was a real saving grace to me, and what I learned and what I will continue to work on is that we all have, here I go, spouting off some doctrine. It appears to me that underneath our busy minds with all the thoughts and worries and ego and everything we have, there is something inside of all of us that's very beautiful. And there isn't a single person on this earth that doesn't have it inside. And that through certain disciplines that we can touch it. It can be through music for some people. For me, because I grew up in a confused environment, I know all of you grew up in perfect environments, but and whatever my particular nature is like, I need a discipline where I remind myself all the time, regularly, of who I really am. And when I forget to remind myself, my ego takes over and I start grasping, and then when I sit back and remember to get back on the cushion and breathe, then I think, oh yeah, that's where I'm trying to go and that's what it's about. But it's a silent awareness, and it's very compatible with the Unitarian philosophy, because a Buddhist who, I think I can speak for us, who understands what Buddhism is about, doesn't have a doctrine. Buddhism isn't a doctrine of belief. All of the beliefs that they, or the path, is just a raft. It's only a skillful way of getting to the point of seeing clearly. And when you get to the point, you let the raft go, and you also recognize that there are many rafts to get there. So in that way, it's compatible with Unitarianism. It doesn't argue with anybody and say, we have the final truth. One of the rules is you keep your mind open and you don't ever claim that something you can describe in words is the final truth. So anyway, my spiritual path is to keep working on waking up out of my neurotic preoccupations into the present moment and recognizing what we all have in common and learning to connect and to trust.
Well, that was a great time saver because my thoughts consist of what she said.
You should have gone first.
No, our backgrounds are very similar. I want to thank Barbara for the flattery. I guess I'm fooling some people that she puts me higher on the scale of spiritual development. I'm a work in progress. But starting with the history, my spiritual journey began in 1925 when a family of, a mixed family, a lapsed Mormon, my grandfather, moved from Utah to St. Louis with my mother, who was 5 years old at the time. My mother's older sister remained in Utah, and I have first cousins who are Mormons. That older sister was in college, and so I have first cousins who are very much practicing Mormons. As my mother grew up in the St. Louis area, she went to different neighborhood Protestant churches and didn't really put a label on herself. But after World War II, when she met my dad, when they were engaged, she converted to Catholicism. And I was aware of that. I was born in 1954. They were married in 48. I was aware of that from a young age. My mother told me that she converted to Catholicism. There was no secret about it when she met my dad. But even at the age of 7 or 8, that struck me as somewhat odd. I mean, Catholicism isn't just what you are. How do you convert? And what is your motivation for doing that? Is it a label you stick on yourself? And now I am, when last week I wasn't? What is the set of values? So I've pondered that pretty much all my life. But then I should say, too, that I told the line growing up as a good Catholic boy, 8 years of Catholic school, learned my grammar from the nuns, and, I took my lumps, but they were pretty good teachers. I remember in second or third grade, when the Mass was still done in Latin, I asked my godparents, my dad's first cousin and her husband were my godparents, and I asked them for a missal, which is, of course, the Mass and lots of other things, too, readings. And I thought it was really cool. Here's the English on one page and the Latin on the other page, and I learned to recite those things in Latin at a young age. So there was a discipline to that, I think, has served me well. But I didn't miss Mass living at home until I left for college. And then when I got to the University of Missouri in Columbia, I was too lazy to find the Newman Center. It wasn't high on my list of priorities. And I tended to go to Mass in college when various girlfriends did. But I guess it was when I was in college that the question occurred to me. I began to question some of the rules of the Catholic Church. For example, I was always taught when I was a kid that to miss Mass on Sunday was a mortal sin without a good reason. And when I was in college, it struck me, why in the world is missing Mass on Sunday the equivalent of murdering somebody? All kinds of, let's not name the heinous crimes, but why in the world is missing Mass on Sunday the equivalent? Eternal damnation. Well, okay, I guess I'll get out of bed. So I guess everyone here knows that I was in the Peace Corps right out of college when I was just turned 22. And similar to what Lisa described, and I wrote down, as Dean wrote, the high schoolers' remarks, the phrase, a journey of discovery, and it certainly was for me. Even while I was in training in Peace Corps, in the first month I was there, I tend to dream and remember my dreams most vividly when I'm very tired, and in fact, you know, maybe sleepwalk or act out or something, when I'm most exhausted. So there was one Sunday when we were touring around in a van, and I think we had been bowling in one place in Thailand, visited a lot of temples, and I was just tired. So I went to bed, and in the middle of the night, I woke up with a very real vision of the Buddha in red robes, floating on a glowing golden cloud above my bed, and immediately I was on my knees and down, and when I looked up, it was gone. But it got my attention. It gave me pause to think about what I was stepping into and where I was and what the meaning of Buddhism was to me. So I paid attention while I was there. I didn't from that moment call myself a Buddhist, but it grew on me gradually. I had a realization like Lisa did, her story about the Hindu boy, that Thailand and other countries are full of good, honest people who love their children and want to see their societies work through honesty, good citizenship, and hard work. I think anyone who says that, of whatever their religious stripe, is sadly deluded. Anyone who says that it belongs to them exclusively, I mean, is sadly deluded. Then, while I was in Peace Corps, I traveled to Nepal on a holiday. I was there at Christmas time, and another sort of eye opener I had was I went to Christmas Mass, Catholic Mass, in Kathmandu. I was flying home on Christmas Day, so before I went to the airport, I went to Mass, and I was questioning, and you know, Nepal was a real spiritual journey. It was a time of solitude. I walked in the mountains for 7 days and soaked in hot springs alone for two whole days. So there was a lot of introspection during that time. And when I went to Christmas Mass in Kathmandu, there weren't many Westerners there. I didn't see tourists there. They were local people. But it just struck me as odd. There was a dissonance there. It struck me as a cultural mismatch and a Western imposed idea of people who, not to judge them, but I didn't understand their motivation, and I was sure at that time that it was a way of identifying with a Western culture. So I saw a dissonance there. I thought that why should there be Catholics in Nepal at all when they already have a rich, viable, cohesive culture and a way of thinking. So by that time, probably when I walked out of Mass that day, I said, you know, I really am a Buddhist. And I won't repeat all the things that Lisa said about it being a way of finding inner peace, about it being a journey rather than a destination. Those are true, and I feel the same way. So I was able to say goodbye to Catholicism for many reasons. One is that I saw a lot of hypocrisy in following a rigid set of rules that may or may not have a relation to your everyday moral behavior. One of my favorite lines to describe that is George Carlin was commenting on the change in the rule where you know, used to be, when I was growing up, you couldn't eat meat on Fridays. I ate fish every Friday of my life until they took the rule away when I was maybe in high school. But George Carlin said, yeah, but there's still people doing time in purgatory on the meat wrap. You know, what is this absolute? What is this? So, you know, I just didn't think they had the answers. I think the Catholic Church is wrong on population and its effect on the environment. I think that there's room in any sincere, devout Christian's outlook for effective family planning, and I think that the planet needs to stop the number of people, stop the growth in the number of people. I was also disillusioned with the Church's official inaction on certain political situations, especially in Central America, Guatemala, Nicaragua in particular. I think they were wrong. And I really thought that the truth really is not tied to anyone's culture, and that Christianity, Catholicism in particular, is tied to a culture. Earlier during the week, I was in a group of Prairie people here, right out in the lobby. We had a meeting, and someone I was making some self-deprecating remark about my interruptions or my humor or my inappropriate use, and somebody said no, I think of you as deep. Well, I'm not deep. I read a little Buddhism and I struggle with it. I'm not sure about reincarnation or nirvana. I'm sure that I'll never, experience that, especially the nirvana. I do see it as a way to search for truth that's meaningful to me. It's an individual thing. It's a way to define our motivation and my motivation for contributing to a better society. I still struggle with negativity. This is the Catholicism rearing its head again. Here's my confession. I struggle with negativity, racism, sexism, white privilege, and parenting, the things I do wrong. I have to say that I found parenthood to be a mystical, humbling, and challenging experience, even more so than marriage. Racism.
Not even a teenager.
Huh? She's not even a teenager. Yeah, not even a teenager yet. Yeah, she's been a joy. For example, on racism, I know I was raised in a fairly racist household and culture. I wonder sometimes when I hear somebody going by with the speakers thumping whether my reaction is whether it's really crappy music or whether I have, whether it's racism that colors my acceptance or lack of acceptance of rap music, for example. And I struggle with that. I'm telling you frankly that I don't know. I don't have it ironed out. I don't like it as music, but there are other things that linger. But I think what I have learned is one thing, and something that Buddhism I don't think really addresses, is that I can't stand injustice. I think maybe more than a year ago when I read the children's story and I couldn't finish the part, I don't remember who was here, but it was when the black folks were turned away from the hotel. It was at a time when I was reading memoirs of Primo Levi, who was an Auschwitz survivor. And just the man's inhumanity to man overwhelmed me at that moment. Here's another one, another case of these huge societal injustices. But then on the other hand, I have to say I don't do enough about it, and I feel guilty about that. There's a lot of work yet to be done on the environment, women's and racial equality. When I was a Buddhist monk 2 years ago, Greg, the Canadian-American monk who was there, stated his view that eventually there will emerge a distinctly North American Buddhism that does address and give a higher priority to equality, the role of women in Buddhism, and also racial injustice. And I've said enough.
We wanted to leave a little time for people to speak of their own spiritual journey. So if people would like ash is a plant.
Maybe I was going to be up for a woman to talk to me. And my answer to Warren when he said, how did I get here, was I came on my bike. But you know, it is a serious answer because bicycling is very important to me. And I describe myself sometimes facetiously as a fundamentalist vegetarian. You know, I think I've grown beyond that and accepted meat eaters more. But another way I describe myself, and people ask me if they don't ask me, you don't talk about it, is as a foul weather Unitarian, which I think some of you probably are too, because you know, on a Sunday morning I like to go bike riding because the land is really important to me. I think it's real fundamental. I'm real place-centered and earth-centered. And I read Thoreau sometimes, and I feel a lot of commonalities with his thoughts where he, you know, really revered nature and said that heaven is under our feet as well as over our heads. And I think there's a... and I was thinking also about a line or a passage in The Color Purple where she's talking about how, in this case she's talking about God and how if there's a beautiful field of flowers and you go by it and you don't appreciate that, that's an offense to God, you know. we're supposed to appreciate flowers. And what else? Oh, there was a passage from, I think it's from Maya Antonia by Lilith Cather that I really identify with because I was raised non-Christian. I mean, but I really wasn't raised with any real religion, which I really consider myself lucky. I mean, they kind of sent me to Sunday school, but I just kind of ignored it, and that was fine. but she... Maybe some of you remember this, where she's talking about, this is a pioneer woman, she's talking about her kids, she has all these kids, and she talks about how they, as parents, provide for their physical needs, but left their spirits alone. And that's kind of how I think of the spirituality. It's up to us to find our own.
Other Goliath.
I think I agree with and have experienced very what you've talked about here. And I need the centering and the going out in the woods and hugging a tree is probably about the best thing I can do for myself. But there's something out of my Rooten Baptist background that I missed. And I experienced a snippet of it last night when the choir burst into the I can't remember the term. What happens after the crucifixion? What's it called? Resurrection of the Bombay Minor Mass blew me away. But it's the same thing I experienced in church when we get up and it was rowdy joy. But it was all-encompassing, rowdy joy. And it's the same thing I experienced when I was a group of folk dancers, which you can't do anymore. You're doing a Turkish dance for those people whose knees used to bend. And everybody would be absolutely in sync. It's something I can't describe. And you can't know what it is unless you've experienced it. It's that thread of electricity that goes through everybody at the same time. That's two. This for me.
Yeah. I just want to briefly comment that I've folk danced for years, and the highest high I've ever had is in folk dancing. Understand. But there is this wonderful, all these bodies, all in rhythm, all together, that is very difficult to express in words.
I'd like to react to echo something else that Dolita said, and that is that I was somewhat reluctant to come up here and do this because, you know, there aren't any Unitarian saints, and I'm certainly not one, and I didn't want to, you know, lay my life out as an example for everyone to follow, but as a common thread. And I think Dolita touched on that. That I don't expect that. I do expect that everyone here has experienced very similar emotions and journeys, you know, realizations and inspirations as I have had. Could have been any of us up here.
I actually am going to be helping out a little bit in next week's service, and in that process of thinking about hunting for hope, I really thought a lot about this theme and where did I come from. And I didn't run away from any other religion. And my parents, who were either, in the case of one, totally atheistic and a-religious, in the case of the other one, raised Jewish, but sort of had to leave it to marry the atheist. They wanted some church to be their kids in because they thought we should go to church. So they brought us to Unitarian church, but they were not really Unitarian. They brought us. So even though I was raised, like you said, with this ethic and this philosophy, I think I really had to figure it out for myself. And many of you know that I have a brother Jewish, a sister Muslim, and another brother atheist and two religious. And I think that really shows what happened when my parents handed us a religion whose philosophy was, or at least what was conveyed to us, well, whatever. And the only one that stayed Unitarian, I think what I developed, there were a couple of things that I just sort of crystallized out for me. One of them is the acceptance of my own ignorance that I think is essential to the Unitarian belief system. And I felt that that is really, really important for me to make it. That I'm a little bit humble about what we know. And that doesn't mean we can't keep hunting and aiming for knowing more, but it's what separates us from the Catholic Church and many other religions that profess to know. And I think coming to an acceptance of we don't know, I'm not an atheist, never be an atheist, can't be, we don't know. It's really, in many ways, very comforting to me. You know, I don't have to worry about getting it wrong. The other thing is, this business of coming at it from all these angles. In order to be friends with my siblings in all of their various religions, I also had to come to a sense that it's okay to come at this speaking a different language. That we're communicating the same feelings, the same wishes, the same needs, whether we're speaking Arabic or whether Hebrew, and by speaking those languages, meaning speaking those religious languages, and that we're this sense of commonness, that we're all aiming at the same thing. And even though my sister thinks that her way is the only way to get there, I know it's one way to get there, so I can accept that she's doing that, which I need to do.
And I think that's one of the fundamental things I got out of the Universalist teaching, was that there's many paths to truth, and there's no corner on it, and that you darn well better listen to what other people have to say, because somebody who is absolutely divergent from you in so many ways will still have a core of truth to speak if you only listen to them. See ya. One more, and then we'll stop. Orange, I thought.
In talking about this tonight at circle dinner, the word oneness came up. And Delita mentioned that feeling of moving at the same time as everyone else in the dance. It occurred to me that's a feeling of oneness that we sometimes feel in nature, that we're part of the universe, and that's a oneness that we belong to. Using different paths to achieve the same end of wanting I think for most people to lead a good life and be a good person, that's a sense of oneness. But also in talking to Lisa about meditation and realizing that there's also a oneness that is just one, and just comes down to your inner peace and your core, and that what I think most of us are searching for is finding that true oneness, but also experiencing that oneness that comes from within.
Good, thank you all. It was wonderful to hear your own personal histories and your journeys. I haven't spied any guests or visitors, so I'll look.
Oh, yes.
Did I?
Yeah.
Larry's wife. May we have your first name, please?
Yeah, this is my wife, Gal. I was going to say at one point up there, I was actually relieved not to see any guests or visitors today. Other than my lovely wife, because this is a very personal thing. It can be confusing to someone who's checking us out as a possible guest. So it was actually nice to have everyone here. Well,
exercising my unitary right to disagree. Confusing at all to anyone who came in here for the first time with no clue of what Unitarians are all about and heard people bearing themselves, offering their own experiences, and sharing what sources of light you've uncovered for yourselves. So thank you for coming.
May I ask again your first name? I still don't know.
Yeah. Oh, right now?
Yeah.
Okay. We know who you are, we just missed an important detail. Okay, I received a call from Karen Navy at Shere Shemayim. They're having their first auction today starting at 1 o'clock, right during our business meeting. But it's at the Goodman Jewish Community Campus, which is 2884 Timberline in Verona. I have directions if you want to go. They do stress that they have art in their auction, as well as a homemade quilt and services like we all do, massage, etc. There's a conference called Creating Healthy Congregations, Seven Vital Signs, with Peter Steinke. Peter Steinke was one of the people who was referred to at the Planning for Conflict and UU Resolution, UU Congregation. Service project on Sunday, April 30th. If you want to add a song or make a change, please bring it to Orange or Delita. Delita's attention. And provide 35 copies of the material. So if you really want it, bring 35 copies to them. Also let them know if you have a songbook at home. This is an all points bulletin. For people who have prairie songbooks at home, to please bring them in so we can get everything rebound. They may be in like little corners behind sofas, you know. So if you could just take a moment and check this week or this month whether you might have one that would love to be rebound. Phoenix, beautiful prairie members. Yes, I have reached $2,500, one quarter of my funds for the big ride. Now I will need help at a fundraiser. Who and how would we be able to speak with for help? So you can talk to Phoenix or perhaps Mechie about that. I don't know. Mechie's been being very helpful, so we need to do some more fundraising. We've got three quarters of the way to go, and you need money by May. By May 19th, so we're getting closer. Barbara Rains, free blood donations by prairie members to the Red Cross, Blood Bank, John Peterson, Ann Pryor, and Aaron Pryor Ackerman. Schedule of other donor sites is on the bulletin board. She will be putting that. Okay. There's a question about when spring fling is going to be, so you need to talk to Randy if you have deep concerns at this point in time about the spring fling.
Oh my goodness.
Any prayer-related announcements we've missed?
Well,
Okay, we're ready for our closing hymn, 193 in the Niyu hymnal. Darkness, nothing comes to birth, and without light, nothing flowers.
Thank you for a good service today. I'd like to remind you of the big announcement that I did not say, which is today is our spring parish meeting. What we're going to do is, as soon as possible, put the tables and chairs out, get our food, and hopefully we'll start the meeting by 11:45. Please keep the hymnals out, because one of the things we will be doing is saying the bond of union as part of the spring meeting. So
maybe we could put the books on the table here.
Okay.
Oh, I see.